Welcome back, Hemingway listeners, to the Hemingway List, the podcast where we do things. The Hemingway. Day six of isolation, I think. I think it's day six. I think I might have said day six yesterday, but I think I got it wrong. Because I know I worked last Friday, and today was Thursday. Right? No, wait. Yeah, so this is day six, yeah. Having a great time, just having a real ball. What have I done today? Isolation diary. Ate some chicken. End of list. I am drinking a decaf coffee because it's my nothing drink. I'm kind of addicted to decaf coffees now because I just want to sip something because I'm bored. Is anyone else in that boat? I think I asked that yesterday. Actually, I did do quite a lot today. I was pretty productive in terms of writing stuff. Book things. We're talking about chapter 9 of The American. Newman got rejected, but not a complete loss. Not a complete rejection. He got a, ask me again in 6 months. No, it wasn't even an ask me again in 6 months. It was a, I'll let you keep hanging out with me, but you are banned from asking me again for 6 months. So it wasn't necessarily ask me again in 6 months. It's just like, if you ask me again within the next 6 months, I will no longer hang out with you. That's what it seemed like, at least. That's what she was saying. And what did you think of his proposal? Would you have taken it? Simply Productive says, Anna. Yes. You need to watch Schitt's Creek. It gets better the longer it goes. If you appreciate dry humor, and it seems that you do, then Schitt's Creek is a great way to go. Yeah, I think I do appreciate dry humor, and I think I will like it. Favorite line from the pilot, no, you get murdered first for once. It's ridiculous, and it knows it. Written by Eugene Levi, with his son Daniel Levi, both of whom are title characters. But you know, I'm being silly. I know precisely how to hook you. Oh, yes, I do, because one of the characters has a tendency to be verbose. Okay. 2 minutes out of your isolation and I'll have you hooked. All right, we're going to have a look at this two-minute YouTube clip.
Now is not the time for pettifogging.
I won't be dressing up.
I say, don't be a dewdropper. Throw some concealer under those peepers, make like a swell, and go put on the ritz.
Oh, okay, so there's a character that uses very obscure language. Cool. All right. It didn't even take me 2 minutes. I'm in. Add to my vocabulary. In the YouTube clip just now, whenever she used a obscure word, a definition popped up on the screen. I'm wondering, is that part of the show or just part of the YouTube? Because if it's actually part of the show where whenever they say an obscure word, a definition comes up, that's pretty cool. I would watch that. I'm going to watch it anyway. I need a good show, and I've heard very good things. Yes. Apparently you edited your text, and your explanation for your text was order of words, speaky, speaky, typey, fasty. Fair enough. Simply Productive also says, in response to Newman getting rejected, the fact that she's willing to see him again tells me that she quite likes him, that she's probably attracted to him or felt a camaraderie immediately. I'm willing to bet they are well suited for each other. It was a brash proposal, and I would have said no. The last time I was proposed to was during an argument, and that relationship ended up becoming undermined by it. A marriage isn't a bargaining chip. If you need to use it once, you'll need to use it again, and the relationship will fail. So I'm kind of nervous at his brashness as a result. Though we, the readers, mark his intention and know he's quite serious, this madam in question doesn't. She has barely even met him. Very true. I think when you propose to someone and they're considering it and then you then go and try to like make a sales pitch, you know, you make all these promises and try to persuade them. As soon as you get to the point where you're trying to persuade someone as part of your proposal, I think it's better to just kind of hands up. Hey, you know what? Don't worry about it. I'll come back. We'll come back to this another time. You know, I don't want to be standing here telling you how good it's going to be to be with me. Yeah. So yeah, I think for me, when he started to go into that kind of thing, not a good proposal. No, there's no romance in that, you know. If you do say yes to that, you're always going to remember the moment of becoming engaged as sort of a negotiation, right? Like when you decide to buy a car because the salesman has been standing there talking, you know, selling you this car and using all these sales techniques. And then you always feel a little bit afterwards like, oh God, did he just, you know, pull the wool over my eyes or what? So yeah, if I ever propose to someone, I don't think I'm going to go and plead my case as part of the proposal. I read in James's Wikipedia page about switching to dictation mid-career, but I thought that would have the opposite effect on his writing, making the sentences shorter and tighter. I was thinking of speechwriters who write for the text, for the presidential addresses and the like. My understanding was that it is more effective to write simpler and shorter sentences when they are spoken. When you're reading, you can see whole sentences written out in front of you and you can jump up a line if you need to get your bearings. When you're listening, you have to hold the whole sentence in your mind, and that's harder to do if it's complex with many clauses. So when you're writing something that is supposed to be read out loud, like when you're writing a speech, you do want shorter and easier sentences, because when you listen to a speech, you want your audience all to be able to easily follow along with the speech. So yeah, you do use punchier sentences when it's written for being spoken. But dictating as opposed to sitting down and writing, it might make your sentences a bit more simplistic and maybe a little bit shorter, but it will make you ramble a little bit. And it will make not the sentences themselves won't be more convoluted, but the prose will be more convoluted. Because that's what we do as writers. We write a sentence and then we comb back over it and make it as elegant as possible, right? And nicely readable. And we want that sentence to unfold before the reader in the best way. You know, there's 1,000 ways you can write what you're trying to write, what's the best way? And then you try to figure that out and then you write it. when you speak, it just kind of fumbles out of your mouth. And you tend to arrange your words in simple ways and simple sentences, but the prose on the whole will be a little bit fumbled, I think, from my experience. You know, your experience may vary. To answer your question from yesterday, it says, wait a minute. I've just skipped from one comment to another. I thought I was still reading Simply Productive's response, but I'm now reading Acoustic Eels' response. That whole thing about the Wikipedia and the dictation thing was Acoustic Eels. Sorry, Acoustic Eels. And sorry, Simply Productive, for muddling up your things. Thanks, Simply Productive, for the TV show recommendation. I'm definitely going to do it. Acoustic Eels. And that means I skipped the first half of Acoustic Eels' comment. It started like this. I totally thought he was digging himself a deeper and deeper hole the whole time he kept talking. I was expecting Madame de Sintry to get upset and smack him or something, but then it said her attitude seemed to be a consent that Newman should say more, so I guess it was okay. Yeah, I was a bit surprised at that too, that, you know, a guy's... You've said no, and a guy's like standing there pleading his case, and that the woman would be like, okay, I'll hear you out, right? Like, it feels like the more you try to beg, like it seems like begging at that point, no matter how eloquent you are, it's not going to endear you to that person. To answer your question from yesterday, I would watch a Twitch streamed reading, but only since it's quarantine right now and I know I'll be home whenever it happens. In real life, I'm not sure I will be able to tune in. Yeah, fair enough. I was thinking about it. I don't think I'll do it. Like, not that many people seemed interested, so, you know, there's that. I do thank you for saying that you're interested. But also, Twitch is really hard. Like, it's not a user-friendly platform at all. And, yeah, I just figured, let's just keep it what it is. Right, why complicate things? This system works. This system's been going on for something like 900 episodes now in a row, daily. 900 days in a row, that's crazy. So why mess up a good thing, you know? It is what it is, and I love what it is, and there's no guarantee that if I become a Twitch streamer that I'm going to even enjoy it. I think the reason, the guiding thing behind it, the one thing that was appealing, was the thought of being able to have a direct line to listeners while I'm doing the podcast. You know what I mean? Do you know what I might do? This is an easier idea. When I record the podcast, is jump on the Discord server. And anyone who wants to can jump in the Discord server and listen along in the Discord server and chat in the Discord chat at the same time. Yeah, maybe I'll do that. There's no need for the video part of it, but just so that now and then, it would just be cool to have one or two people live in the recording who I can even sort of unmute at certain points if they want to speak on the podcast and just go straight on via Discord. We've already got the Discord server up and running. So maybe that's what I'll do. Maybe that's what I'll do. Stay tuned. Jan Brunt. Hey, Jan Brunt's back. Welcome back. Jan Brunt says, finally caught up so I can comment. In regards to the character of Madame de Cintry, I am very much reminded of Irene from the Foresight Saga. Can't say I know it. She's beautiful, she's mild, she's reserved, she's admirable, she's virtuous, she's coveted as a wife. But, like, there isn't actually much character there. Those aren't attributes that tell you much about her or her inner life. This may be a plot device by James. We may learn more about her as Newman does, but I get awfully tired of the classic short shrift to female characters. Mrs. Tristram got a fully formed persona right off the bat, so I'm hoping Madam gets something better than object of affection. I had a similar thought, but my thought was more like blaming her rather than the author. Like, seems like sometimes when people are coveted, let's say, or more attractive, it's like they obscure more of their personality so that it, kind of knowing that if you're attractive and you don't really show much of your personality, people will just sort of assume the best or even project what they want your personality to be. And you see so many gorgeous people, men and women, who kind of have no strong personality, or at least they don't show it. Right? Maybe I'm just making that up. I don't know. I'm thinking of a specific person in my head who's someone I know in real life who's absolutely gorgeous, but just, I don't know. Everything is, it's like she keeps every card close to her chest, you know, like you never, it's always just a vague, polite smile and pleasantries. I don't know what I'm saying. Anyway, let's move on. So my mind went to that, like, this Madame de Cintry is like not really even like letting him know who she is. But I figured that was because she maybe secretly enjoyed him chasing her. I don't know. Most likely, it's more what you said, and the author just wanted her to be like the, you know, generic, beautiful, coveted potential wife. All right, let's keep reading I'm quite tired and I'm talking slowly as a result, which is probably quite annoying to listen to. So let's read chapter 10 and get back to isolating ourselves, eh? Some important isolating to be done. Oh God, I'm just having a quick look at how long chapter 10 is. It is long. Goddamn. All right, here we go. Newman continued to see his friends, the Tristrams, with a good deal of frequency, though if you had listened to Mrs. Tristram's account of the matter, you would have supposed that they had been cynically repudiated for the sake of grander acquaintance. We were all very well so long as we had no rivals. We were better than nothing. But now that you have become the fashion and have your pick every day of three invitations to dinner, we are tossed into the corner. I'm sure it is very good of you to come and see us once a month. I wonder you don't send us your cards in an envelope. When you do, pray have them with black edges. It will be for the death of my last illusion. It was in this incisive strain that Mrs. Tristram moralized over Newman's so-called neglect, which was in reality a most exemplary constancy. Of course, she was joking, but there was always something ironical in her jokes, as there was always something jocular in her gravity. I know no better proof that I have treated you very well, Newman had said, than the fact that you make so free with my character. Familiarity breeds contempt. I have made myself too cheap. If I had a little proper pride, I would stay a while, and, when you asked me to dinner, say I was going to the Princess Borulaska's. But I have not any pride where my pleasure is concerned, and to keep you in the humour to see me, if you must see me, only to call me bad names, I will agree to anything you choose. I will admit that I am the biggest snob in Paris. Newman, in fact, had declined an invitation personally given by the Princess Borulaska, an inquiring Polish lady to whom he had been presented, on the ground that, on that particular day, he always dined at Mrs. Tristram's, and it was only a tenderly perverse theory of his hostess of the Avenue d'Iéna that he was faithless to his early friendships. She needed the theory to explain a certain moral irritation by which she was often visited, though if this explanation was unsound, a deeper analyst than I must give the right one. Having launched our hero upon the current which was bearing him so rapidly along, she appeared but half pleased at its swiftness. She had succeeded too well. She had played her game too cleverly, and she wished to mix up the cards. One moment, please. Sorry about that. She mixed up the cards. Wished to mix up the cards. Newman had told her in due season that her friend was satisfactory. The epithet was not romantic, but Mrs. Tristram had no difficulty in perceiving that. In essentials, the feeling which lay beneath it was... What? The feeling which lay beneath it was... Indeed, the mild, expansive brevity with which it was uttered, and a certain look at once appealing and inscrutable that issued from Newman's half-closed eyes as he leaned his head against the back of his chair, seemed to her the most eloquent attestation of a mature sentiment that she had ever encountered. Newman was, according to the French phrase, only abounding in her own sense, but his temperate raptures exerted a singular effect upon the ardor which she herself had so freely manifested a few months before. She now seemed inclined to take a purely critical view of Madame de Cintry, and wished to have it understood that she did not in the least answer for her being a compendium of all the virtues. No woman was ever so good as that woman seems, she said. Remember what Shakespeare calls Desdemona, a super subtle Venetian. Madame de Cintry is a super subtle Parisian. She is a charming woman, and she has 500 merits, but you had better keep that in mind. Was Mrs. Tristram simply finding out that she was jealous of her friend on the other side of the Seine, and that is in undertaking to provide Newman with an ideal wife, she had counted too much on her own disinterestedness. We may be permitted to doubt it. The inconsistent little lady of the Avenue de Iena had an insuperable need of changing her place intellectually. She had a lively imagination, and she was capable at certain times of imagining the direct reverse of her most cherished beliefs. With a vividness more intense than that of conviction, she got tired of thinking aright, but there was no serious harm in it, as she got equally tired of thinking wrong. In the midst of her mysterious perversities, she had admirable flashes of justice. One of these occurred when Newman related to her that he had made a formal proposal to Madame de Cintry. He repeated in a few words what he had said, and in a great many what she had answered. Mrs. Tristram listened with extreme interest. "But after all," said Newman, "there is nothing to congratulate me upon. It is not a triumph." "I beg your pardon," said Mrs. Tristram. "It is a great triumph. It is a great triumph that she did not silence you at the first word, and request you never to speak to her again." "I don't see that," observed Newman. "Of course you don't. Heaven forbid you should. When I told you to go on your way and do what came into your head, I had no idea you would go over the ground so fast. I never dreamed you would offer yourself after 5 or 6 morning calls. As yet, what had you done to make her like you? You had simply sat, not very straight, and stared at her. But she does like you." "That remains to be seen." "No, that is proved. What will come of it remains to be seen. That you should propose to marry her without more ado could never have come into her head. You can form very little idea of what passed through her mind as you spoke. If she ever really marries you, the affair will be characterized by the usual justice of all human beings toward women. You will think you take generous views of her, but you will never begin to know through what a strange sea of feeling she passed before she accepted you. As she stood there in front of you the other day, she plunged into it. She said, 'Why not?' to something which a few hours earlier had been inconceivable. She turned about on 1,000 gathered prejudices and traditions as on a pivot, and looked where she had never looked hitherto. When I think of it, when I think of Claire de Cintry and all that she represents, there seems to be something very fine in it. When I recommended you to try your fortune with her, I, of course, thought well of you, and in spite of your sins, I think so still. But I confess I don't see quite what you are and what you have done to make such a woman do this sort of thing for you." "Oh, there is something very fine in it," said Newman, with a laugh, repeating her words. He took an extreme satisfaction in hearing that there was something fine in it. He had not the least doubt of it himself, but he had already begun to value the world's admiration of Madame de Cintry as adding to the prospective glory of possession. It was immediately after this conversation that Valentin de Bellegarde came to conduct his friend to the Rue de l'Université, to present him to the other members of his family. "You are already introduced," he said, "and you have begun to be talked about. My sister has mentioned your successive visits to my mother, and it was an accident that my mother was present at none of them. I have spoken of you as an American of immense wealth and the best fellow in the world who is looking for something very superior in the way of a wife." "Do you suppose," asked Newman, "that Madame de Cintry has related to your mother the last conversation I had with her?" "I am very certain that she has not. She will keep her own counsel. Meanwhile, you must make your way with the rest of the family. Thus much is known about you. You have made a great fortune in trade. You are a little eccentric, and you frankly admire our dear Claire. My sister-in-law, whom you remember seeing in Madame de Cintry's sitting room, took, it appears, a fancy to you. She has described you as having a beaucoup de cachet. My mother, therefore, is curious to see you." "She expects to laugh at me, hey?" said Newman. "She never laughs. If she does not like you, don't hope to purchase favour by being amusing. Take warning by me." This conversation took place in the evening, and half an hour later, Valentin ushered his companion into an apartment of the house of the Rue de l'Université, into which he had not yet penetrated, the salon of the Dowager Marquise de Bellegarde. It was a vast high room with an elaborate ponderous mouldings, painted a whitish grey along the upper portion of the walls and the ceiling, with a great deal of faded and carefully repaired tapestries in the doorways and chair backs, a Turkey carpet in a light colour, still soft and deep in spite of great antiquity, on the floor, and portraits of each of Madame de Bellegarde's children at the age of 10 suspended against an old screen of red silk. The room was illumined exactly enough for conversation by half a dozen candles placed in odd corners at a great distance apart. In a deep armchair near the fire sat an old lady in black. At the other end of the room, another person was seated at the piano playing a very expressive waltz. In this latter person, Newman recognized the young Marquise de Bellegarde. Valentin presented his friend, and Newman walked up to the old lady by the fire and shook hands with her. He received a rapid impression of a white, delicate, aged face, with a high forehead, a small mouth, and a pair of cold blue eyes which had kept much of the freshness of youth. Madame de Bellegarde looked hard at him and returned his handshake with a sort of British positiveness which reminded him that she was the daughter of the Earl of St. Dunstan's. Her daughter-in-law stopped playing and gave him an agreeable smile. Newman sat down and looked about him while Valentin went and kissed the hands of the young Marquise. "I ought to have seen you before," said Madame de Bellegarde. "You have paid several visits to my daughter." "Oh, yes," said Newman, smiling. "Madame de Cintry and I are old friends by this time." "You have gone fast," said Madame de Bellegarde. "Not so fast as I should like," said Newman, bravely. "Oh, you are very ambitious," answered the old lady. "Yes, I confess I am," said Newman, smiling. Madame de Bellegarde looked at him with her cold, fine eyes, and he returned her gaze, reflecting that she was a possible adversary, and trying to take her measure. Their eyes remained in contact for some moments. Then Madame de Bellegarde looked away, and without smiling, "I am very ambitious, too," she said. Newman felt that taking her measure was not easy. She was a formidable, inscrutable little woman. She resembled her daughter, and yet she was utterly unlike her. The colouring of Madame de Cintry was the same, and the high delicacy of her brow and nose was hereditary. But her face was a larger and freer copy, and her mouth, in especial, a happy divergence from that conservative orifice, a little pair of lips, at once plump and pinched, that looked when closed as if they could not open wider than to swallow a gooseberry or to admit an "oh dear no," which probably had been thought to give the finishing touch to the aristocratic prettiness of the Lady Emmeline Atheling, as represented 40 years before in several books of beauty. Madame de Cintry's face had, to Newman's eye, a range of expression, and delightfully vast as it the wind-streaked, colour-flecked distance on a western prairie. But her mother's white, intense, respectable countenance, with its formal gaze and its circumscribed smile, suggested a document signed and sealed, a thing of parchment, ink, and ruled lines. "She is a woman of conventions and proprieties," he said to himself as he looked at her. "Her world is the world of things immutably decreed, but how she is at home in it, and what a paradise she finds in it. She walks about in it as if it were a blooming park or a garden of Eden, and when she sees this is genteel or this is improper written on a milestone, she stops ecstatically as if she were listening to a nightingale or smelling a rose." Madame de Bellegarde wore a little black velvet hood tied under her chin, and she was wrapped in an old black cashmere shawl. "You are an American," she said presently. "I have seen several Americans." "There are several in Paris," said Newman jocosely. "Oh, really?" said Madame de Bellegarde. "It was in England I saw these, or somewhere else, not in Paris. I think it must have been in the Pyrenees many years ago. I am told your ladies are very pretty. One of these ladies was very pretty, such a wonderful complexion. She presented me a note of introduction from someone, I forgot whom, and she sent with it a note of her own. I kept her letter a long time afterwards. It was so strangely expressed. I used to know some of the phrases by heart, but I have forgotten them now. It is so many years ago. Since then I have seen no more Americans. I think my daughter-in-law has. She is a great gadabout." "Well, she sees everyone." "Excuse me." At this, the younger lady came rustling forward, pinching in a very slender waist and casting idly preoccupied glances over the front of Oh, hay fever's kicking in. Over the front of her dress, which was apparently designed for a ball. She was in a singular way at once ugly and pretty. She had protuberant eyes and red lips, strangely red. She reminded Newman of his friend, Mademoiselle Nioche. This was what that much obstructed young lady would have liked to be. Valentin de Bellegarde walked behind her at a distance, hopping about to keep off the fast-spreading train of her dress. "You ought to show me more of your shoulders behind," he said very gravely. "You might as well wear a standing ruff as such a dress as that." The young woman turned her back to the mirror over the chimney piece and glanced behind her to verify Valentin's assertion. The mirror descended low, and yet it reflected nothing but a large unclad flesh surface. The young marquise put her hands behind her and gave a downward pull to the waist of her dress. "Like that, you mean?" she asked. "That is a little better," said Bellegarde in the same tone, "but it leaves a good deal to be desired." "Oh, I never go to extremes," said his sister-in-law, and then, turning to Madame de Bellegarde, "What were you calling me just now, madame?" "I called you a gadabout," said the old lady, "but I might call you something else too." "A gadabout? What an ugly word. What does it mean?" "A very beautiful person," Newman ventured to say, seeing that it was in French. "That is a pretty compliment, but a bad translation," said the young marquise. And then, looking at him a moment, "Do you dance?" "Not a step." "You are very wrong," she said simply, and with another look at her back in the mirror, she turned away. "Do you like Paris?" asked the old lady, who was apparently wondering what was the proper way to talk to an American. "Yes, rather," said Newman. And then he added with a friendly intonation, "Don't you?" "I can't say I know it. I know my house, I know my friends, I don't know Paris." "Oh, you lose a great deal," said Newman sympathetically. Madame de Bellegarde stared. It was presumably the first time she had been condoled with on her losses. "I am content with what I have," she said with dignity. Newman's eyes at this moment were wandering around the room, which struck him as rather sad and shabby, passing from the high casements with their small, thickly framed panes to the sallow tints of two or three portraits in pastel of the last century which hung between them. He ought obviously to have answered that the contentment of his hostess was quite natural. She had a great deal, but the idea did not occur to him during the pause of some moments which followed. "Well, my dear mother," said Valentin, coming and leaning against the chimney-piece, "what do you think of my dear friend Newman? Is he not the excellent fellow I told you?" "My acquaintance with Mr. Newman has not gone very far," said Madame de Bellegarde. "I can as yet only appreciate his great politeness." "My mother is a great judge of these matters," said Valentin to Newman. If you have satisfied her, it is a triumph." "I hope I shall satisfy you some day," said Newman, looking at the old lady. "I have done nothing yet." "You must not listen to my son. He will bring you into trouble. He is a sad scatterbrain." "Oh, I like him, said Newman genially. "He amuses you, eh?" "Yes, perfectly." "Do you hear that, Valentin?" said Madame de Bellegarde. "You amuse Mr. Newman." "Perhaps we shall all come to that," Valentin exclaimed. "You must see my other son," said Madame de Bellegarde. "He is much better than this one, but he will not amuse you." I don't know, murmured Valentin reflectively, "but we shall very soon see. Here comes Monsieur Monfleury." The door had just opened to give ingress to a gentleman who stepped forward and whose face Newman remembered. He had been the author of our hero's discomfiture the first time he tried to present himself to Madame de Sintry. Valentin de Bellegarde went to meet his brother, looked at him a moment, and then, taking him by the arm, led him up to Newman. "This is my excellent friend, Mr. Newman," he said very blandly. "You must know him." "I am delighted to know Mr. Newman," said the Marquise with a low bow, but without offering his hand. "He is the old woman at second hand," Newman said to himself as he returned Monsieur de Bellegarde's greeting. And this was the starting point of a speculative theory in which that the late Marquise had been a very amiable foreigner with an inclination to take life easily and a sense that it was difficult for the husband of the stilted little lady by the fire to do so. But if he had taken little comfort in his wife, he had taken much in his two younger children, who were after his own heart, while Madame de Bellegarde had paired with her eldest born. My brother has spoken to me of you, said Monsieur de Bellegarde, and as you are also acquainted with my sister, it was time we should meet. He turned to his mother and gallantly bent over her hand, touching it with his lips, and then he assumed an attitude before the chimney-piece. With his long, lean face, his high-bridged nose, and his small, opaque eye, he looked much like an Englishman. His whiskers were fair and glossy, and he had a large dimple of unmistakably British origin in the middle of his handsome chin. He was distinguished to the tips of his polished nails, and there was not a movement of his fine, perpendicular person that was not noble and majestic. Newman had never yet been confronted with such an incarnation of the art of taking one's self seriously. He felt a sort of impulse to step backwards as you do to get a view of a great facade. "Urbain," said young Madame de Bellegarde, who had apparently been waiting for her husband to take her to the ball, "I call your attention to the fact that I am dressed." "That is a good idea," murmured Valentine. "I am at your orders, my dear," said Monsieur de Bellegarde, "only you must allow me first the pleasure of a little conversation with Mr. Newman." "Oh, if you're going to a party, don't let me keep you," objected Newman. "I am very sure we shall meet again. Indeed, if you would like to converse with me, I will gladly name an hour." He was eager to make it known that he would readily answer all questions and satisfy all exactions. Monsieur de Bellegarde stood in a well-balanced position before the fire, caressing one of his fair whiskers with one of his white hands, and looking at Newman half askance, his eyes from which a particular ray of observation made its way through a general meaningless smile. "It's very kind of you to make such an offer," he said. "If I'm not mistaken, your occupations are such as to make your time precious. You are in a, as we say, dans les affaires." "In business, you mean? Oh, no, I have thrown business overboard for the present. I am loafing, as we say. My time is quite my own." "Ah, you are taking a holiday," rejoined Monsieur de Bellegarde. "Loafing. Yes, I have heard that expression." "Mr. Newman is an American," said Madame de Bellegarde. "My brother is a great ethnologist," said Valentin. "An ethnologist," said Newman. "Ah, you collect Negroes' skulls and that sort of thing." The Marquis looked hard at his brother and began to caress his other whisker. Then, turning to Newman, he sustained urbanity. "You are travelling for your pleasure," he asked. "I am knocking about to pick up one thing or another. Of course, I get a good deal of pleasure out of it." "What especially interests you?" inquired the Marquis. "Well, everything interests me," said Newman. "I am not particular. Manufacturers are what I care most about." "That has been your specialty?" "I can't say I have a specialty. My specialty has been to make the largest possible fortune in the shortest possible time." Newman made this last remark very deliberately. He wished to open the way, if it were necessary, to an authoritative statement of his means. Monsieur de Bellegarde laughed agreeably. "I hope you have succeeded," he said. "Yes, I have made a fortune in a reasonable time. I am not so old, you see." "Paris is a very good place to spend a fortune. I wish you great enjoyment of yours." And Monsieur de Bellegarde drew forth his gloves and began to put them on. Newman, for a few moments, watched him slide his white hands into the white kid, and as he did so, feelings took a singular turn. Monsieur de Bellegarde's good wishes seemed to descend out of the white expanse of his sublime serenity with the soft, scattered movement of a shower of snowflakes. Yet Newman was not irritated. He did not feel that he was being patronized. He was conscious of no special impulse to introduce a discord into so noble a harmony. Only he felt himself suddenly in personal contact with the forces with which his friend Valentin had told him that he would have to contend, and he became sensible of their intensity. He wished to make some answering manifestation, to stretch himself out at his own length, to sound a note at the uttermost end of his scale. It must be added that if this impulse was not vicious or malicious, it was by no means void of humorous expectancy. Newman was quite as ready to give play to that loosely adjusted smile of his, if his host should happen to be shocked, as he was far from deliberately planning to shock them. "Paris is a very good place for idle people," he said, "or it is a very good place if your family has been settled here a long time, and you have made good acquaintances and got your relations round you, or if you have got a good big house like this, and a wife and children, and a mother and a sister, and everything comfortable. I don't like that way of living, all in rooms next door to each other, but I am not an idler. I try to be, but I can't manage it. It goes against the grain. My business habits are too deep-seated. Then I haven't any house to call my own or anything in the way of a family. My sisters are 5,000 miles away. My mother died when I was younger and I haven't any wife. I wish I had. So, you see, I don't exactly know what to do with myself. I am not fond of books, as you are, sir, and I get tired of dining out and going to the opera. I miss my business activity. You see, I began to earn my living when I was almost a baby, and until a few months ago, I have never had my hand off the plough. Elegant leisure comes hard. This speech was followed by a profound silence of some moments. On the part of Newman's entertainers, Valentine stood looking at him fixedly with his hands in his pockets, and then he slowly, with a half-sidling motion, went out the door. The Marquis continued to draw on his gloves and to smile benignantly. "You began to earn your living when you were a mere baby," said the Marquis. "Hardly more, a small boy." "You say you are not fond of books," said Monsieur de Bellegarde, "but you must do yourself the justice to remember that your studies were interrupted early." "That's very true. On my 10th birthday I stopped going to school. I thought it was a grand way to keep it, but I picked up some information afterwards," said Newman reassuringly. "You have some sisters?" asked old Madame de Bellegarde. "Two sisters, splendid women. I hope that for them the hardships of life commenced less early." "They married very early, if you call that a hardship, as girls do in our Western country. One of them is married to the owner of the largest India rubber house in the West." "Ah, you make houses also of India rubber?" inquired the Marquis. "You can stretch them as your family increases," said young Madame de Bellegarde, who was muffling herself in a long white shawl. Newman indulged in a burst of hilarity and explained that the house in which his brother-in-law lived was a large wooden structure, but that he manufactured and sold India rubber on a colossal scale. "My children have some little India rubber shoes which they put on when they go to play in the Tuileries in damp weather," said the young Marquis. "I wonder whether your brother-in-law made them." "Very likely," said Newman. "If he did, you may be very sure they are well made." "Well, you must not be discouraged," said Monsieur de Bellegarde with vague urbanity. "Oh, I don't mean to be. I have a project which gives me plenty to think about, and that is an occupation." And then Newman was silent a moment, hesitating, yet thinking rapidly. He wished to make his point, and yet to do so forced him to speak out in a way that was disagreeable to him. Nevertheless, he continued, addressing himself to old Madame de Bellegarde. "I will tell you my project. Perhaps you can help me. I want to take a wife." "It's a very good project, but I am no matchmaker," said the old lady. Newman looked at her an instant, and then, with perfect sincerity, "I should have thought you were," he declared. Madame de Bellegarde appeared to think him too sincere. She murmured something sharply in French and fixed her eyes on her son. At this moment, the door of the room was thrown open, with a rapid step of Valentin reappeared. "I have a message for you," he said to his sister-in-law. "Claire bids me to request you not to start for your ball. She will go with you." "Claire will go with us," cried the young Marquis. "En voilà du neveu. She has changed her mind. She decided half an hour ago, and she is sticking that last diamond into her hair," said Valentin. "What has taken possession of my daughter?" demanded Madame de Bellegarde sternly. "She has not been into the world these 3 years. Does she take such a step at half an hour's notice and without consulting me?" "She consulted me, dear mother, 5 minutes since," said Valentin, "and I told her that such a beautiful woman, she is beautiful, you will see, had no right to bury herself alive." "You should have referred Claire to her mother, my brother," said Monsieur de Bellegarde in French. "This is very strange." "I refer to her to the whole company," said Valentin. "Here she comes." And he went to open the door, met Madame de Cintré on the threshold, took her by the hand and led her into the room. She was dressed in white, but a long blue cloak, which hung almost to her feet, was fastened across her shoulders by a silver clasp. She had tossed it back, however, and her long white arms were uncovered. In her dense fair hair there glittered a dozen diamonds. She looked serious, and Newman thought rather pale. But she glanced around her, and when she saw him, smiled and put out her hand. He thought her tremendously handsome. He had a chance to look at her full in the face, for she stood a moment in the centre of the room, hesitating, apparently, what she should do without meeting his eyes. Then she went up to her mother, who sat in her deep chair by the fire, looking at Madame de Cintré almost fiercely, with her back turned to the others. Madame de Cintré held her cloak apart to show her dress. "What do you think of me?" she asked. "I think you are audacious," said the Marquis. It was but 3 days ago when I asked you as a particular favour to myself to go to the Duchess de Lusignan's that you told me you were going nowhere and that one must be consistent. Is this your consistency? Why should you distinguish Madame Rubinieux? Who is it you wish to please tonight? I wish to please myself, dear mother, said Madame de Cintry, and she bent over and kissed the old lady. I don't like surprises, my sister, said Urbain de Bellegarde, especially when one is on the point of entering a drawing room. Newman at this juncture felt inspired to speak. Oh, if you are going into a room with Madame de Cintry, you needn't be afraid of being noticed yourself. Monsieur de Bellegarde turned to his sister with a smile, too intense to be easy. I hope you appreciate a compliment that is paid you at your brother's expense, he said. Come, come, madame. And offering Madame de Cintry his arm, he led her rapidly out of the room. Valentine rendered the same service to young Madame de Bellegarde, who had apparently been reflecting on the fact that the ball dress of her sister-in-law was much less brilliant than her own, and yet had failed to derive absolute comfort from the reflection. With a farewell smile, she sought the compliment of her consolation in the eyes of the American visitor, and perceiving in them a certain mysterious brilliancy, it is not improbable that she may have flattered herself she had found it. Newman, left alone with old Madame de Bellegarde, stood before her a few moments in silence. Your daughter is very beautiful, he said at last. She is very strange, said Madame de Bellegarde. I'm glad to hear it, Newman rejoined, smiling. It makes me hope. Hope what? That she will consent some day to marry me. The old lady slowly rose to her feet. That really is your project, then? Yes. Will you favour it? Favour it? Madame de Bellegarde looked at him a moment and then shook her head. No, she said softly. Will you suffer it, then? Will you let it pass? You don't know what you ask. I'm a very proud and meddlesome old woman. Well, I am very rich, said Newman. Madame de Bellegarde fixed her eyes on the floor, and Newman thought it probable she was weighing the reasons in favour of resenting the brutality of this remark. But at last, looking up, she said simply, How rich? Newman expressed his income in a round number which had the magnificent sound that large aggregations of dollars put on when they are translated into francs. He added a few remarks of a financial character which completed a sufficiently striking presentiment of his resources. Madame de Bellegarde listened in silence. You are very frank, she said finally. I will be the same. I would rather favour you on the whole than suffer you. It will be easier. I am thankful in any terms, said Newman, but for the present, you have suffered me long enough. Good night. And he took his leave. All right, there we go. That was a bloody long chapter. Thank you very much for listening. I'll see you tomorrow.